People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Welcome, one and all, to another episode of the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm Ben Sternke, and I'm here with my co-host. It feels like it's been a while since the three of us were able to be on an intro together because of vacation schedules, etc. So Christy and Matt, it's great to be with you this morning, this fine morning.
The gang is back together.
The gang is back together.
I'll spend time with anybody who thinks it's great to be with me. I'm sort of a sucker for that.
Yeah, I think most of us are. Most of us enjoy being enjoyed. There's something about that that's really, a deep part of our humanity. Anyway, I just got off a couple weeks vacation, so I'm trying to remember how to talk into a microphone and do work kind.
Keep it up.
So I'm a little rusty, but I think I'm doing okay so far. Christy, speaking of talking into a microphone, Christy's got a little bit of a sore throat today.
Yeah, man. I kind of been like pushing it a little bit, and I think my body is like, hey, remember me? Yeah. I spoke at a conference, Desperation Conference, which is super fun here in Colorado Springs. And then I went to another retreat, and I came back and preached, and my throat is like on fire. So
not in the spirit filled sense.
No.
No, more in the inflamed. Yeah. Maybe on the verge of an infection sense. Okay.
That's funny.
Anyway. Well, sorry to hear that, Christy. And I hope you rest up.
I hope
you rest up well. So,
But I'm glad to be back together.
Yeah.
It's good to see you together, Christy. Yeah.
We have some fun, exciting things happening.
Yeah, this week. This week we have our learning community, Reconstructing Faith. It's on Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern. It's online. It's a pay what you can. Those who are premium members of the Gravity Commons community, it's included in that premium membership. So if you've been thinking about that, ways to support us, or wanting to get in on a lot of the constructive, generative work we're doing, it's $25 a month. I think it's really cheap in terms of all the things you get. But one of the things you get is this monthly learning community where we're developing an awareness of how did Jesus preach the gospel. And so we've done four sessions already, 4 months. So if you join, you become a premium member, you get access to those past four learning communities. You can watch them. But if you haven't come to any and you don't want to be a premium member, you can pay whatever you want to come to as many classes as you want. And so I invite the people listening, maybe you've never come to one of these things before, or maybe you just listened to the podcast, Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, pay what you can and join us. We're going to talk about putting it all together. How did Jesus conceive of the bad news that his proclamation and his purification and his political activity and his invitation to participate in what he was doing, how did he see that as rectifying what was wrong with the world? You know? And it's fascinating. You know, like those of us who grew up, you know, in a youth group led by a wonderful youth group leader like Christy Penley, we love the Bible. And it's fascinating to go back to the scriptures and say, okay, what did Jesus actually think was wrong? Mm-hmm. And how is he rectifying it? And then how do we translate that to today, right? Yeah. So it's a little different than what I was taught, in seminary and in other places. So anyway, if you can't be there live, just register anyway and you'll get a recording. But I just want to invite everybody to come. We're going to put it all together. We're going to talk about, so what does that mean for gospel proclamation today?
It's great.
Does that sound exciting? Sound fun?
Super great. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And just to be clear, we're talking about Wednesday, July 24th.
Yeah.
So thanks, listener, man. Hopefully you didn't miss it. But even if you did, all the recordings are going to be available. And you can go to gravitycommons.com/reconstructing to both ways to register are available.
Yeah.
On that page. Yeah. And I'll just say, we're calling this Reconstructing Faith because we are a lot of our listeners and a lot of the people in our general audience have gone through or are going through some kind of thing that they call deconstruction. Now that word gets used in a lot of different ways, but primarily what we mean by it is kind of rethinking what we learned and thinking about it again and saying, well, wait a second, does that really cohere with how my life works and mm-hmm. how I think about God and all of that kind of thing. And so there is an element of deconstruction in some of this stuff because of, what we've heard about the gospel. But there's also a really intentional element of reconstruction to say, actually, we don't need to just throw out Christianity. We don't need to just throw out our faith. There is a way of wrapping our minds around, what the gospel means in a way that does cohere with, our deepest intuitions. So anyway, I'm excited about that. That's Wednesday, July 24th, 8 p.m. And hope you can join
us. There'll
be a
link in the show notes, but it's just gravitycommons.com/reconstructing.
Yeah.
It's really simple.
Yeah.
Simple. We also have a book club too.
Yeah. We're just looking for ways to one of the things we've heard from people who are connected to the podcast and also who are connected to the Gravity Commons community is how important a group of people who we can be with, where we don't have to be on guard, we don't have to hide what we think, where we can just relax and be seen and known, and not be attacked or put under discipline for not. Yeah, there's a lot of anxiety right now and fear and sadness about having Christian community locally, and so we're looking for ways to be more. To gather more. And so one of the ideas that we're going to experiment with over the next several months is having a book club. We're going to read Tim Alberta's The Kingdom and the Power and the Glory, which is his, an investigator. He's a white evangelical journalist who's going around the country to various Christian nationalistic churches and gatherings and trying to figure out why. Why is this happening? Mm-hmm. What happened? He's a pastor's kid, and he grew up a Republican, and he's definitely really adjacent to sort of MAGA, but he definitely disagrees with it. And so I think it's fascinating because his story, I think, maps and mirrors a lot of our own stories. But also it's fascinating because I come to a lot of different conclusions about what's wrong and why it's wrong than Tim does. And so there's so much that's and congruence, and so much in discongruence or incongruity, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I think it will make a fascinating conversation. Chapters are easy to read. I think the audiobook is free on Spotify. Ben, I think you're listening to the audiobook if you have Spotify Premium. And you can pick up and read any chapter. So if you can't read the whole book and you just want to dip in once or twice. Anyway, that'll be Fridays at noon Eastern. So lunch hour for noon Eastern people, maybe coffee hour for people on the West Coast. We'll do it weekly. Yeah. So
awesome.
Join us.
Yep. Weekly book club. And that'll be for people who are, paid members of the Gravity, community. Yeah. And so again, there'll be, or you can just go to, gravitycommons.com/community and there, figure out how to join there. And then it'll be easy to find the space that we'll be in. So, starting August 2nd, is that the first Friday of August?
I don't know, Ben.
Yeah, I think it's coming up. Yeah, August 2nd. Because my kid is hiking that day, I know. Oh, I just put it in the calendar.
One of my kids has a birthday that day.
Oh. All right. Well, today we're introducing who, Matt?
Yeah, this is David Peters, and we talked to him about his book, Post-Traumatic Jesus. He goes through the Gospels in this book and looks at the various encounters and teachings of Jesus from a trauma lens. He's a chaplain or ex-chaplain, and now he's a pastor, Episcopal priest. And so he's got he talks about his own trauma that he experienced in the military as a military chaplain and how he's recovering from that, but how that enables him to approach the scriptures being sensitive to people who are carrying around a lot of hurt and pain, which we need that today, I think.
Yeah.
When we go to the scriptures, we don't need just need ideas, but we need to be seen and known by a God who can understand and connect with the deep harm or pain or sadness that we have. And so David then helps us read the scriptures in a way to say, oh gosh, God has always been doing this. Yeah. And God and Jesus did this. And Jesus himself is a traumatized person. I mean, it's hard to go through crucifixion and not experience trauma, right? Yeah. So anyway, it's a great conversation, great book. Yeah. And David was a delightful person.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just to put even a finer point on that, I think that's one of the primary things that felt like a surprising insight to me during this interview was, oh, Jesus was traumatized. He was a traumatized person. Because I think sometimes we have this idea about Jesus because he's God, like that he's just sort of floated through life and didn't really experience things in their depth, you know, like, oh yeah, but he was crucified, but he was God, so he was fine.
Right.
But no, he was fully human. And so any fully human person, you know, who is crucified, tortured to death, you know, obviously that's an extremely traumatic experience. And I just found I found an immense amount of comfort in that thought to know that God, like God himself, has gone through this in the person of Jesus. Anyway, it's it was really profound for me. So listener, I hope you are helped by this interview with David Peters.
Yeah.
Let's get to be a part of it, so I'm excited to listen.
Mm. All right. Great. All right.
Well, let's get into it. Here we go.
David, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Part of your story that I find intriguing is how you served as a military chaplain before taking a position in a local church parish ministry. Could you tell us a little bit about how you grew up, kind of your spiritual development and journey, and then how you found yourself serving in Iraq as a military chaplain?
Yeah, I grew up in American evangelicalism, or what would be called fundamentalism, self-described. And my journey in the Christian faith was always very personal to me and kind of how I related to Jesus as a child, then as an adolescent, as a teenager. And so much of that was shaped by that world that is pretty well documented now in sort of post-evangelical culture, both for its good qualities and for the qualities that I feel like may have taken me a little further away from Jesus many times. But my own journey to try to figure that out and who I was going to be as a Christian and maybe even as a Christian leader certainly led me to the military. It was kind of the one approved secular organization you could kind of join as a young fundamentalist boy. And I knew I was called to ministry, but I wasn't sure that the fundamentalist evangelical world was a good fit for me. And I kind of explored that a little bit, and I knew that was my calling. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps when I was 17, then went to boot camp and went to Bible college, fundamentalist Bible college, and kind of did all those things together. And then got out of the military, was in seminary, and that's when the Iraq War kicked off. And I realized they needed a lot of Army chaplains. I had served in the military before. So that seemed like a good fit for me. I also needed health insurance at the time. I just had a first child. And, you know, it's really amazing how when you have to grow up fast, what you do to grow up.
Yeah,
and I also knew that my spiritual journey of joining the Army was going to be part of it, too. And that took me out of the fundamentalist world into a new environment that was very multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, in every multi-sense of the word. The military embodies a really big cross-section of America. And it was there that I discovered the Episcopal Church by praying Compline in the barracks. There's different kinds of Episcopalians. There's cradle Episcopalians, people that were born in the church. About 50% of, I think, modern Episcopalians fall into that category. And there's, you know, ladle Episcopalians that served in soup kitchens and things like that and found the church. Dreidel Episcopalians, you know, people that, you know, maybe married a Jewish person and said, like, man, my church doesn't really approve of this. Maybe I should find a church that's cool with inter-religious marriages. We have a number of different kinds of Episcopal. I'm a barracks Episcopalian. Okay. I learned how to pray in the barracks with the Book of Common Prayer and with an Episcopal Army chaplain. And it opened my eyes to a new way of praying and relating to God. And that's where I found this church. And so I transitioned to the Episcopal Church while I was an Army chaplain. And then when I got out, finally, I became an Army Reserve chaplain and then started working in churches. And then God called me to be a church planter in an area where a church was closing. And I came to Pflugerville, Texas about 6 years ago and started a church like from scratch. And I didn't start the church. It was people here that started the church. I got to be part of that. And I think the Holy Spirit moved in their hearts and built this community that way. And it's a very much a post-traumatic community in that people come to church plants like ours from a lot of church trauma and church, I guess, community relations troubles. In some ways, you could couch it that way. Some come from other churches, but a large group of us come from no church at all. The people that have not been part of a church for many, many, many years. And so it's a new experiment, but we're also like a normal church in that we worship God together and pray together and serve the world in Jesus' name together. And that's the parts that I like about it is people discovering that the way I discovered the Episcopal Church in a really, at a very pivotal point in my life, which was military service, Iraq, deployment, coming home from that. And the church was really there for me during that time. So I want our church to be a place for people that have similar experiences of transition, of new beginnings, of going through that dark night of the soul where traumatic events in our lives turn our world upside down. And one of the things that I think happens to a lot of people when they go through really world upturning things is that their view of God changes. You know, the very basic question of often atheists is if you know there is a God that is supposed to be in control of the world and loving, why do these things happen and why do they happen to me? Why do they happen to us? Those are real questions. And I think when people of faith go through big traumatic events or just things that turn their world upside down they didn't expect to happen, that does change our view of God. And I think often the God of our childhood that is almost like Santa Claus in some ways, transactional, you know, we do good stuff, God hooks us up with benefits and blessings, that God dies or ceases to exist in traumatic events. And so our view of God has to shift and change. And I think it is the view of God that is presented in the Bible, probably more than any other place. And it was the God I discovered through the Episcopal Church. And it was always the same God that I've always worshipped. But, you know, sort of my vision of God and through Jesus, the post-traumatic Jesus, was one that I wanted to write about in a more focused, specific way for the church in this book.
We'll be right back.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Let's get back to the show.
Well, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your experience specifically, you know, with trauma. You know, you mentioned the military, which I think that's what we used to associate with trauma, right? PTSD was like, oh yeah, that's what vets come home with. But you know, nowadays we're starting to realize and talk about trauma in a more broad sense, right? You mentioned that people that go to your church, you know, have a lot of church trauma. It's similar to our church, the one that Matt and I co-lead together with another priest. It's very similar. And so I wonder if you could just maybe share a bit about how you became acquainted with trauma and how this became kind of a, you know, if we can call it this, like a special interest for you that you write about and think about and talk about a lot.
Yeah, I don't think I knew much about PTSD, the psychological diagnosis, when I became an Army chaplain. But that was a world where we were studying it a lot, researching it a lot. The Army was scrambling to try to figure out how to prevent it, how to treat it in veterans that were coming back with all sorts of symptoms, and also symptoms that made life really difficult for them and people around them. That's sort of the D in PTSD, the disorder, is that it disorders our world and the world around us, and it makes living really hard. Suicide being the worst extreme form of that, but also a lot of other kinds of things along the way. But, you know, so I learned about it as America kind of woke up to PTSD and what it was and what it meant. And the nice thing about being a veteran with PTSD is that people believe me, that they believe I have it, because I can point to this war that I was involved in. And you're like, well, obviously that's true. We can know how that works. Mm-hmm. The problem with PTSD for most people in America and around the world today is nobody believes them. The diagnosis comes out of studying both Vietnam veterans and survivors of sexual assault, which were largely women. And those two groups had very different experiences in life in many ways, but they had the same symptoms. And studying them together, and, you know, one group that is believed, Vietnam veterans, people didn't question whether they went through horrific things in Vietnam generally, whereas survivors of sexual assault and abuse were never believed and still aren't in many cases and places. And so that is part of the big wound. The word trauma means wound in Greek. It's a Greek word used in the Bible occasionally. There's lots of different words for wound in every language, including Greek in the New Testament, but one of them is trauma. And so that idea of the wound being not just a physical wound in the way we think of the piercing of our flesh or the bruising of it, but a deeper psychological, spiritual wound that makes us not trust anyone anymore. Yeah. That we want to protect ourselves from future events like the ones we experience. So we become very reactive, very defensive. The classic fight, flight, or freeze impulse kind of just takes over, floods our nervous system. And then we can't really like relate to people. When you feel like the world is a big threat, it makes human relationships really difficult, especially the ones that are closest to us. And that is the wound of PTSD or trauma, is that inability to trust. And that has profound effects on our faith. We believe, you know, we trust in church every Sunday. Churches kind of state what they believe in the creed, which means I believe. And the word belief and trust are very intertwined in English and every language. So this idea of I lost my ability to trust is really what we're saying when we say I have PTSD. We're saying I lost the ability to feel safe in my normal environment. I lost the ability to love in some ways, because love has to involve some trust. So, and that is a relationship with God too that is affected by trauma. And so I think my experiences in Iraq but also my experience of coming home from Iraq to a shattered marriage, one that ended in divorce, was just as traumatic for me spiritually as anything in the war was, because it was kind of like I felt like I was doing everything right. I was serving my country. I was trying to be a good chaplain, trying to be a good husband, you know, like all these things that we try to be good at. And then when failure happens, it's like I must have done something and God must have failed me in that. And I felt that really profoundly, and I was very angry. And I didn't realize that anger is also part of PTSD, the feelings of betrayal, because that's really what we are lamenting in our grief about trauma, is that I used to be this happy person, or I used to be this trusting person. I used to be fun-loving. I used to be able to, like, go places and do things and just live life, and now I can't. What's wrong with me? And, you know, there's a lot of good treatment for PTSD out there, if people can kind of do it. A big part of that often involves sobriety, which is really hard to do when you have PTSD, because the numbing is kind of a... And I had trouble with alcohol for the same reasons everybody else does. Like, it was a great solution to that anxiety that I was feeling all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to me, like, PTSD is treatable medically, but there's a deeper part of it that is our spiritual self that also has PTSD. And I think that Jesus has it too. If we believe that he still has the scars from his physical wounds, his hands, his feet, his side, why wouldn't we believe that he has invisible wounds like we do from our traumas and traumatic events? I don't think you can get crucified and not have what we would call PTSD or something closely related to it. And what that looks like in a resurrected body and in a resurrected Christ, a risen Christ, I think has profound implications for how you and I can live in this world too, after traumatic events, that we experience the first fruits of the resurrection in Jesus. So Christians are like Jesus in some ways in the resurrection, that we have a new chance at life after trauma. And how do we live that through the power of the Holy Spirit, to me, is really what is so exciting to watch when you see someone making that transition and really waking up again to be a gift of love to the world and trusting other people and learning to love again. And it's like learning to start life all over, being born again. Maybe that's what it is. You know?
That's a good all metaphor. We should write that down.
Yes. That's all these things. It's written in a book I've heard about.
I don't think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, David. Well, I would like to press into this provocative phrase. We're talking about trauma, but the title of your book uses the word post-traumatic. And I wonder if you could say what you mean by post-traumatic, and then in what sense is Jesus post-traumatic?
Yeah, the Jesus we meet in the Gospels, all four of them, is written about after his resurrection. I don't think the disciples that are writing, or the other people that were writing those books, were like, you know, exactly, these are not like written in real time with Jesus. I do think the Gospels are quite recent from Jesus' life. I don't go with the whole, like, they were written a really, really, really long time, you know, long after everyone forgot about it or something. But I think, like, they are eyewitness accounts. They're so confusing, and, you know, that what else could they be if we had written them more carefully, we would have gotten the details more correct, I think. But they're definitely written in the chaos of the real experiences, but they're written reflecting on his crucifixion and his resurrection. So every story in the Gospels is written by people who either witnessed or were like in somehow part of his crucifixion and resurrection experiences, and profoundly shaped by that. So everything that happens in the story somehow relates to that most traumatic Friday afternoon. And to me, that becomes an interpretive tool for people with PTSD to say, I am living a post-traumatic life right now. My whole life is post-trauma, post-traumatic. Not that other things might not happen, might happen to me. Of course they might, and they will in many cases. But you know, these very pivotal traumatic events that do shape a person's life in kind of a BC and AD kind of way. Most people's traumatic experiences account for a very small sliver of time of their life, although people with complex PTSD, it can be a longer abusive relationship or institutional relationship or something. And that is a whole new subject of research as well. But for most people living in this post-traumatic world, the writers of the New Testament are living in that world too. They are in their own post-traumatic reflections on the life of Jesus, shaped by the trauma of the crucifixion, the betrayal of Judas and even Peter, the betrayal of Jesus in that he leaves them and he dies, and they are shocked by that. And just all that stuff is like in every story and every page, and just reading it in through that lens to me is helpful to understand why they're writing about the things they're writing about.
And you go kind of chapter by chapter and take a look at different themes or stories in the Gospels and illuminate maybe or demonstrate what a post-traumatic lens looks like. But I want to reflect back something I heard, and then I want to ask a question about something I hear trauma survivors struggle with when it comes to the scriptures. I want to reflect back that post-traumatic doesn't mean beyond trauma. It just means after and with trauma. And I think sometimes when we hear post something, we think it's over or now there's a new thing going on. And really, the way that you're using this phrase and the way that I think is more helpful to understand it is, now that trauma is a reality and here, how do we live post this new thing that has emerged? So it's not over and done. It's just around. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's a real fragility with post-traumatic stress disorder and or any kind of post-traumatic experience that I felt. I remember feeling like I can't even drive in traffic anymore without getting so anxious and angry and upset that's a normal thing. Everybody gets a little stressed out with traffic and all kinds of stuff. But why am I getting to the point where I can't like relate to people anymore? Yeah. Why? Yeah. And why is this so? And that fragility is scary, because the thing that got you through the traumatic events, like driving through Baghdad in an armored vehicle, is your steel mind and inability to feel anything and numbness and sort of aggression. And, you know, those are the kind of things that enable one to do those kind of things or to get through them at least. And then this fragility afterwards, why am I so reactive? Why do people, you know, not want to talk to me or be around me? Or, you know, that's the scary part of that post-traumatic existence, but it's not over at all. It's very much re-experienced. And that's the thing, like our hearts and minds and internal nervous systems can't distinguish always from a real threat and one that is a reaction to one that happened a long time ago. And so we reactivate in that way. And I think that explains a lot of people's behavior in the world today. And I had untreated, I was treating it with alcohol. That was about it. And that is untreated PTSD, which, you know, is so mysterious, because most people, at least I did, because I was a chaplain in Iraq. I was not an infantry soldier, a pilot. You know, I went with all these guys and women, men and women, to do these kind of things and watch them and observe them and was there with them. But I was a ministry of presence. And so I never felt like I could have traumatic stuff happen to me. I always felt like there's always somebody that has it worse. And that is a common, you know, problem with getting help for oneself, is saying, well, of course, I don't have it as bad as those people, this one. So owning that for oneself is a pretty big step. And that took me a long time to do. Yeah. And it was through understanding the trauma of Jesus that helped. If Jesus can have trouble with this stuff, maybe I can too.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of experience was really helpful.
And in your book, you lay out sort of the brutal, traumatizing world that Jesus grew up in. And I'll let the listener pick up the book to sort of really get to fill it in with color, right? And to make our imagination sort of come alive with that. But I guess as we have listeners who have experienced trauma, who want to find a way back into reading scripture, one of the things that I hear from people a lot is, so Gravity talks a lot about being like Jesus. And I hear from lots of trauma survivors, I don't want to be like Jesus. Jesus is saying, take up your cross and follow me. But the cross is torture, and my body gets triggered and reactive and shuts down. My nervous system can't embrace torture. So as a pastor, David, and as somebody who's lived with trauma and is reckoning with it, trying to metabolize it, how would you pastor those of us who feel like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question to ask. And it's a really good, it is the question of giving one's will over to somebody else, Jesus particularly. To be a follower of Jesus is to, in some ways, give your will over to the control of another person. And that is what trauma survivors do not want to do, because that is the signature part of the wound of what we would call a traumatic event, is that you have no agency, you have no power to protect yourself. And I felt that in Iraq as a grown-ass man who was in an army surrounded by soldiers. I felt that kind of vulnerability that I could lose my life because of what somebody else does to me, and I have no defense, nothing to do, I can't stop it. And that feeling that rises up of panic and despair and, you know, anxiety is very real. It doesn't ever leave us after that usually, because it gets stuck and we get stuck in it. And so the idea of suffering willingly in some way or even passively does not appeal to survivors of trauma. We want to know, how do I prevent it by being strong enough to resist it or whatever got me in that door, especially when it comes to systemic abuse of in relationships, domestic violence, we used to call it, or abusive systems that I joined, you know, that I involved myself in, and I'll never join another one because I don't want that to happen to me again. That is the profound question. The thing about Jesus once told a story about two brothers. One, their father was a vineyard guy, and so he came in and yelled at him on a Saturday, you know, go out and work in the vineyard. Probably not on a Saturday if they're keeping the Sabbath. On another day of the week, I would yell at my kids on a Saturday, get out and do something, you know, help me with the mulch. And they, you know, he says, go work in the vineyard. One says yes, and then he gets like distracted and doesn't go. And the other son says no. And he then eventually decides to go work in the vineyard. Which one did the will of the father? Jesus asked the audience. They say, of course, it's the second one, the one who said no first, but then actually goes and does it. And old Soren Kierkegaard, who I think understood a lot about trauma in many ways and the human soul and how we react to things, he said, like, those two brothers really show that in order to say yes to God or to faith or to the invitation of Jesus, you have to say no first. Because the only way for your yes to be a real yes is if you can actually say no. And that's where survivors of trauma who were pinned to that cross in many ways, were not able to resist. This is the signature wound of sexual assault, is that you can't stop it. And everybody sort of thinks that you could have or you should have or you should have done something different, the shame of that. But no, you couldn't. That was the problem of it. Or any other kind of traumatic event, it's that helplessness and hopelessness that people have, that they go into that very primal state of survival where you become numb even to the world around you, disassociation, all these other coping mechanisms that people do in severe circumstances that we kind of can't even imagine doing unless we've experienced it. That is the thing that no one ever wants to be in again. But the path that Jesus calls us to is one where we learn how to say no very, very ably, how to be like that second son who says no, 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 so that when he is ready to say yes, it's a real yes. So the yes that Jesus gives to God as he goes to Jerusalem, as he goes through that trial, it is not a completely passive acceptance and resignation to suffering. What it is a very much a yes to what God has called him to do. And he does it completely voluntarily, completely willingly. And so in some ways, the crucifixion is both the most passive event on earth, that he is pinned to the wood, and in that way we can relate to that in our trauma, but it is also the most active participation in one's own destiny that we could ever fully imagine. And it combines in the weirdest way to be both the worst thing and in this redemptive way the best thing. Yeah. And I think that is not where we want to tell people to go in their trauma. If somebody says that to you when you're suffering, oh, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. You know, people have said that to me at times when I was really suffering, and it always made me angry and upset. We never should say that to anybody in any church, but I have heard people say that to me in their reflection on their traumatic events. And I have felt that a little bit about myself. And this in no way says these are good things. These are like wonderful things or in any way like that. But there is this thing that happens when we understand that the wound is the place of God's grace that flows. And that is, to me, the profound mystery of the Christian faith, is that this crucifixion can be these two things all at once. For Christians, we can both see the cross as a symbol of hope and in our suffering, but also in a very real way, never forget that it is the worst thing that ever happened to Jesus, for sure, and probably for a lot of people in the world, the worst thing that could happen to anybody. So to me, that's the paradox of the invitation of Jesus. But you have to learn how to say no. And that's the thing about the recovery from trauma. People have to learn how to not cut off everyone around them and isolate, but to learn how to say no to many, many, many people and things that are constantly barraging them with invitations. Mm-hmm. Once they can say no, getting their own agency back through therapy, through a lot of other things, then they can start saying yes. And the kind of stuff that post-traumatic Christians say yes to is usually places of profound suffering and places of discomfort and dis-ease. And going into, we see this in the mission of St. Francis, a severely traumatized veteran and prisoner of war. He comes out of that experience crazy in any recognizable way that we would say. And he has his whole life. He has symptoms of PTSD his whole life. We don't want to diagnose people from the past too much, but you know, I wrote a book about post-traumatic Jesus, so I'm doing that a little bit with him and other sure. people in the stories. But with Francis, we see this like profound wound. Out of the wound, he starts to minister to the wounded, to people that are suffering in profound ways. And he does that his whole life. Like a lot of his ministry is just like caring for people with leprosy and stuff like that, which is a thankless job. We sort of glorify it now from a distance, but then it wasn't so glamorous. It was actually seen as maybe so foolish that why is he doing that? And that's what that's where the Sermon on the Mount comes in with Jesus. This, reading it through a post-traumatic lens, you can see how people are getting their voice back. People are getting their agency back through the Sermon on the Mount. Not by passively accepting suffering and violence and things like that. When Jesus says, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him, mm-hmm. your left. Walter Wink and others have, written about that, he's saying, when someone hits you with the backhand, tell them to fight you like a man. Fight me like a human yeah. being. Fight me like mm-hmm. an equal. So I can be part of this again. If someone says, carry your pack for 1 mile, carry it two. See, this is the guy that's under the pile taking agency back, taking the pack for another mile. Now he's in control again. So Jesus is calling us to take back control of our lives that were shattered, and our will and our agency and all these other things. And that's the path that Jesus calls people to, the path of no, and the path of resistance to this kind of evil. But it's not one that you can do by just getting a bigger gun. And that's what, in the world of Jesus, Jesus did not just say, like, we got to, like, get better weapons than the Romans. You know, Jesus is not that preoccupied with the Roman Empire like we are today in sort of progressive Christianity. When you read what he says about the stuff that's happening around him, he's kind of always focusing on what are some practical solutions for this problem. You see that in the other writings of the New Testament as well, which we interpret sometimes as being like, you know, go along to get along, like St. Peter's writing about enslavement and husbands and wives. And, you know, these are like more practical ways to survive really awful situations rather than a manifesto about how wonderful the world can be. Because they were written to people that weren't able to just stop living in the world they lived in, just like us. Right. We can't stop living in this traumatized world and a world that we are aware of more trauma than ever around us, right, just through our media, of course, being the biggest source of that, but also through just our imaginations. You know, for some reason, humans have this thing called an imagination, which allows us to do amazing things, but it also allows us to imagine the worst case scenario every time. And people with post-traumatic stress disorder, people with other symptoms from those events, definitely that's one of the symptoms of PTSD, is a foreshortened future. You cannot see good things happening in the world to you or anybody else. And I know that when the pandemic started to roll in, I started to get symptoms like that again that I had in Iraq that made me very insular and very cautious about leaving certain areas and where I felt safe. And, you know, I had that kind of resurface during the early pandemic, and it was uncanny. I was like, what, why am I feeling this? Where is this coming from? That's how this stuff works. It's surprising to us. It shocks us. We're not always aware of that. So to me, like, that's the invitation of Jesus, but it's not an invitation to passively suffer as an eternal victim against your will for the rest of your life in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. That would be hell. That is, in fact, what we would call hell.
Yeah. And now, a word from a sponsor. Hey, the Gravity Commons podcast is supported by Respero. Henry Nouwen once wrote, "The role of a counselor is to help people not suffer for the wrong reasons," which I really like. This is one of the guiding principles of Respero's counselor training. They equip you to listen deeply, ask great questions, and speak words of life into the hearts and minds of hurting people. Their training cohorts, which a lot of our listeners have actually gone through and have said that they really enjoy. Their training cohorts feature lots of personal interaction and practice with feedback, and it's all rooted in the belief that Jesus is the source of life. So check it out at respero.org and learn how to move people toward real transformation, not just symptom removal.
And if I may, Ben, for pastors and ministry leaders, Respero's training is kind of a proven way to identify people in your church who have a gift for counseling and helping others. And it can be a powerful way to help make your church a genuine healing community. So they provide training and supervision that will allow your people to do great work and free up the pastoral staff, right? So, you know, I think we as pastors, we understand our job is to equip the saints for the work of ministry. And I think Respero then kind of digs a little deeper and actually gives those saints sort of the hard and soft skills of how to do the work, right? Yeah. So go to Respero, RESPERO.org, and click on the Counselor Training tab. Listener, this ad is different than other ads. Ben and I are going to be at a conference, and we want you to join us. We did a national gathering for Gravity in 2017. We did a grief kind of retreat last summer, and we've been looking for ways to gather this year with all y'all because we love spending time with you, and we got invited into something called Theology Beer Camp. which is October 17th through 19th in Denver, Colorado. We're joining a host of other people from around the country. We're going to do some podcasting there. Ben, who all is going to be there?
I'm excited about Ilya Delio.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
The unbearable wholeness of being changed my life.
Yeah, incredible. Brian McLaren's going to be there. Diana Butler-Bass, Brian Zond.
We know him.
Other folks.
Yeah, there's going to be lots of podcasting, lots of keynote speaking, and lots of time to hang out. There's going to be a lot of relational time, and we may even record some podcasts. We'd love to record podcasts even with you, listener. They've given us a discount code for all of our listeners because we are a sponsor. Yeah. So if you go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and use the code GravityHobbit, that'll give you an idea of the kind of gathering we're doing here. You get $25 off tickets. Prices go up soon, so register today.
Yep. Beer is optional, by the way.
Yeah, but theology isn't.
Theology isn't, but the beer is optional. All right, that code again, or the website again, friends, is gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. And make sure to use our code GravityHobbit, two Bs, to get $25 off tickets. Hope to see you there. All right, let's get back into our conversation. This is why I would encourage our listeners to pick up your book, because you know some of these paradigm shifts, like reading the Gospels through a post-traumatic lens, like it takes a bit of effort for us to get beyond our knee-jerk response to take up your cross and follow me, and all the associations we've had with that, you know, that you were saying, you know, where it feels like this passive thing, God, who is this powerful, you know, being who's going to punish me if I don't obey, is telling me to take up my cross, and it feels exactly like my trauma, right? But I think, you know, reading it through this other lens and saying, no, actually, that there is an empowerment here, you know, that Jesus is seeking to do, especially even in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, which sometimes can read to us like this, you know, I mean, Martin Luther read it this way, like, oh man, this is such a high bar that Jesus is setting. It's like, well, what if Jesus is actually not setting this high bar in the way that we normally think about it, but what if Jesus is empowering people who have been victimized and who have been traumatized? What if he's empowering them to take agency over their own lives and say, you know what, you are close to God, you can follow me, God is with you. You know, like, what if that's the message of the Sermon on the Mount? What if that's the message of Jesus? And what if somehow take up your cross and follow me is part of that empowerment? I think that's really a profound shift for a lot of us.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate
it.
I appreciate this.
It is. Yeah. Yes.
I wonder, David, as we close here, you know, you're pastoring there in Texas, which is one of the sort of intensely, it's in the news a lot. Texas, the political climate, the religious climate there. And as we move into what seems to be a very interesting 2024 election season, I wonder how you are thinking about pastoring people who are dealing with a post-traumatic Christianity when the sort of public discourse and what's happening on a macro level is extremely triggering, you know? When you've got people with threats of violence or people taking away or threatening to take away civil rights or other kinds of legislative rights. And it seems like if you just keep up with the news that you would have a dozen things a day that would just cause your nervous system to go on tilt. How are you dealing with that personally? And how are you pastoring those in your care to take care of themselves in a season of, you know, uncertainty and violence?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yeah, and it has to be personal to me as well. My psychiatrist a couple years ago was like, yeah, you should really be on social media, maybe the most 30 minutes a day, you know, and it was kind of funny because I'm like, I know there's some people that are only on 30 minutes a day, but you live in this world and we live in this world and we are getting messages all the time. And so many of them are what we now call fear-based. And that is the appeal of politics, is that the crisis, we are in a crisis and I can save you from the crisis, is the message of every politician throughout time and space.
Yeah.
And I notice in this election season, the fear of invasion from, you know, foreigners coming across the border certainly was a big theme in the debate. Very much like a threat to your life, you know, being couched in that language, which does get people activated, including myself, you know, those kind of announcements of threat. I think it's good to recognize that we are always going to have this aware. The bad news is always going to be the one that we pay most attention to, and that we are being manipulated by politics by the promise that there's one guy that can save us and one person that can save us. And that's always the lie of all politics. The Christians that existed in the first and second century, when the scriptures are being written and passed around, they did not live in a political system like we live in. We have a lot more agency, a lot more power, at least we're told we do. And yet we often feel very frustrated by that I don't have enough. And if only people could see what I see in politics and see that my candidate is the one that can save us. Again, as Christians, we've lived under every kind of political system there ever has been. We've made it through. The church will still be here no matter what happens. Like, Jesus will still be present in our communion, and the Holy Spirit will still empower us no matter who is president, or if there isn't a president, or if there isn't a country. Like, we're going to make it through that as a church. That's the promise of faith. And the other part of that is that, you know, when we do make political decisions like voting, I think we should do it in faith. We should ask God, who should I vote for? Who is someone that that doesn't just beat the drums of fear and panic, but someone who does care about the actual political values that I have? I think for Christians, we've always been concerned about people's health care as a church since the dawn of our existence. There's some theories that early Christianity spread because we offered free health care to people. We didn't charge them for praying for healing and comfort care. And I mean, a lot of people can survive the diseases of the ancient world if they had good nursing care, and Christians often provided that. So again, Christians should vote for people that are going to help with health care and a larger scale. I think that's a really good thing to vote for. The fear of the stranger. You know, Christians, we're not afraid of people around the world. We are an international church. We are extra national. We don't believe that our nations define our humanity and other people's inhumanity, like that we're all one blood, all the peoples of the earth. So again, like, dispelling that fear that is so potent in politics that we'll lose or we'll win, I think is something that I try to. And I think that it's not assuming that everybody believes the same things we do about politics. I do think it might be a helpful exercise to say every political party at its best does want America to be a good place to live in. Now, that is a stretch in politics to believe about the other party. And that no matter who gets elected, I'm going to still advocate for the causes that I believe transcend party politics, like justice, mercy, compassion, love. And a lot of that is local. But I do think the trauma of the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan, but especially the Iraq war, the one I was in, I think the fruits of that came into the 2016 election. And we have destabilized other countries around the world as Americans, and we participated in that gleefully often, and now we are destabilized here at home. Yeah. We have a destabilized nation in a way that we've never had before as far as in recent history, and that is the fruit of our destabilizing other places in the world that we, to some degree, may not have had a huge part of or may not. And we were against it, and all those things are true. But that is the reality of I think, American politics. Because Donald Trump is not the only bad person in America. You know, he is empowered by by that lust for power that is the in Jesus' time, when the demonic, how it functioned in the first century, was always about power and the crushing weight of an oppressive system. Mm-hmm. And the demonic always offers power to people. And I think you can see that functioning in the Donald Trump campaign, the sense that people want to be manly again. Men want to be manly again, and they want to be strong, and they want to fight off the enemy. And that appeal to that sort of masculine pride, power, white supremacy, it all goes together. And he embodies that for a lot of people. And to me, that's dangerous in the sense of, the Christian church following Jesus. Jesus' definition of power is totally different. I don't believe Jesus was a complete pacifist in the way that we define that term today politically. I think lots of Roman soldiers converted to Christianity in the early days, and John the Baptist ministry, at least, we can see that happening in an early Christianity. Mm-hmm. And serving in the military was not completely contradictory to that experience. But trying to gain power over other people so you can crush them mm-hmm. and get your way all the time, that is demonic, and Jesus was against that. So I think in this campaign, to see that very clearly and say, whoever people vote for is their business, but to see the empowerment of raw power, I think that's always a dangerous impulse, and Christians should, I think that is dangerous to vote for, and not really in keeping with the Christian values of our country that have been all over the place throughout the centuries, but have always, as Anglican Christians or Episcopalian Christians, we've always said, like, we want our leaders to recognize that they are under God's justice as much as they are accountable to the community.
Wow, we ended with a great banger. Sermon there. Yeah. I think we should take up the offering.
It's a spicy take, though, that you shouldn't vote for authoritarian supremacists. We'll see how that plays. I mean, could be controversial for Christians. You know, in all seriousness, David, thank you for this work, this book, and the way that you're helping pastor those of us who are dealing with our own trauma and wanting to find a way into the Christian faith to see Jesus in solidarity with us, rather than Jesus as somebody who's pushing us towards harm. The book, again, is called Post-Traumatic Jesus, A Healing Gospel for the Wounded. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you both for a great conversation, and I hope we can continue this. And I hope people can take this further than I took it. I think the readers will be able to do that. You will be able to do that with this book.
Amen. Hey, Ben, there's so many parts of this book. The chapters are like, so this is the way I describe it. The chapter, you can read a chapter on the toilet. Like, the chapters are like,
they're short.
Can be read in five minutes, and I'm not exaggerating.
I like a book like that. I find it's so easy for me to like get through a book if I feel like the commitment level to get through a chapter is like, 5 minutes.
Yes.
That's decent. If the commitment level is to get through a chapter is like 20 minutes, I find it just feels, I don't have time for that.
Right.
Even though, I mean, clearly I could just read a few pages, but it feels doable in bite-sized chunks like that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Something I wanted to actually ask him about or talk about, and now I'm forgetting what I wanted to bring up. There was actually something I wanted to bring up.
It was something.
Yeah, there was something I wanted to bring up about trauma and the gospel. And now I can't remember it.
Well, there was something that I was wanting to ask him about that I didn't either. So maybe I'll just do, I'll start with mine and maybe it'll trigger yours, Matt.
All right.
Does that sound okay?
Let's do it.
I appreciated what he shared about kind of reframing some of the phrases of Jesus, and especially like the Sermon on the Mount, out of this sort of moralistic, kind of shaming message of you're not quite good enough yet, and reframing it as empowerment for those who have been under the thumb of oppressive power, empowerment for those who've been traumatized. And I was reminded, I know he talks about in this book, he talks about the Beatitudes as a trauma manifesto. And I wanted to ask him about that. But I was just reminded about how I have this little rant that I go on every once in a while, sometimes just in my own mind. You know, nobody knows that I'm ranting about the Beatitudes. But we've read the Beatitudes through this moralistic lens for so long that it's so hard for us to understand what's going on there. I think it's so easy to read the Beatitudes as you should be merciful, you should be peace, you should be a peacemaker, you should be poor in spirit, you should be. And that's not at all what the Beatitudes are declaring. Jesus is declaring blessing on people who are not used to having blessing declared on them.
Yeah.
Like it's this totally upside down. It's like you think you're on the bottom of the pile. And in many ways you are, but you know what? That doesn't prevent God's blessing, God's grace from like streaming into your life. And so it's this super empowering message. So it's, you know, we go head over heels trying to make poor in spirit into something good. Because it's like, well, Jesus said we should be poor in spirit. No, yes. He didn't. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit.
Yes.
Being poor in spirit's not a good thing in and of itself.
Right.
But Jesus declares it blessed.
Yeah.
And I think it's just like, we don't have a big enough view of God's grace to understand that Jesus doesn't need to, like, as if the only things Jesus would bless are things that are like good and moral. Like, why wouldn't Jesus bless like the scum of the earth?
Yeah.
Of course he would.
Yeah. Anyway. This is related to why I want to do this book study on the kingdom and the power and the glory by Tim Alberta, Ben, because there's a move that's often made that separates politics from religion or politics from Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so then the critique then would be Christians should keep Jesus first. And the problem in America is that Christians make an idol of politics. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that's the best way to frame what's wrong. And I think what you're naming that Jesus does in the Sermon on the Mount is evidence that Jesus doesn't think about it like that. Mm-hmm. Because to declare blessing to the poor in spirit is a socio-political act.
Right.
It's not a religious, the way we think of it. Jesus isn't being churchy. He's opposing the unjust political economy that created and necessitated poor people and people then who would be poor in spirit because of their poverty. Mm-hmm. And we've lost the ability to imagine and inhabit a Christian faith that embodies the socio-political kingdom of God taught and revealed in Jesus. We just, mm-hmm. we can't do it. We either lament the, quote, idolatry of politics, or we're fighting a culture war.
Yeah.
Those feel like the two options. Those are the dominant two Christian postures in the white church in the United States. And neither are what we see embodied in Jesus. I believe in this so strongly. Mm-hmm. That's probably apropos of nothing to do with David's book, but it's a rant that is always being incubated in my heart. I'm just always that's one of my favorite rants, and it's because it's true.
Well, I think it does. I mean, it relates to. I really appreciated what David shared at the end of the episode there, because I think it relates to what he was saying. I think what you're saying relates to how he was encouraging and how he's going to encourage his congregation and how he's encouraging us to think about, you know, this political season where there is this sense in which, you know, everything doesn't hinge on this election, you know, like that kind of a thing. Like that is a manipulation, right? That we're being drawn into. But by the same token, it's like there are very real world effects, you know, that affect healthcare for the poorest among us, right? And that relate to my vote, that relate to who's in power, that relate to all of those things. And so we ought to very like boldly and fully embrace those things which will afford more people to have healthcare, more people to get out of poverty. Like that, those are good Christian things that have always characterized the church. And so, you know, let's do what we can in our political system. You know, like he said in their day, people did not imagine themselves to be empowered in any way to affect anything, you know, having to do with kings and, you know, emperors and all of that kind of thing. They were just trying to survive. But in our day, we do have something. We have this thing called a vote, and we can make our voice known, you know, like we can do something to affect some of these, to affect some of these things. And to, you know, I just appreciated so much of what he shared.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the question I had, and that is, there's been a lot of like research done by sociologists and anthropologists and historians about how the ancient people had a different psychology than we do. One of the best books I've read about this is the book "The Weirdest People in the World," and this sociologist psychologist describes how being weird is a acronym: Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic. How that kind of socio-political being in the world changes our psychology.
Right,
we think differently and see differently and value things differently, et cetera. So, my question I have that I don't have the training to answer is, in what way can we use a modern, even postmodern label of trauma to describe how ancient people experienced suffering, evil, and harm to their bodies and nervous systems? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that, so don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that being crucified wasn't a bummer.
Because they didn't have the word trauma in our understanding.
No, I'm just saying, like, in what way did people's bodies store harm differently? That's all I'm asking. Not that they didn't, but in what ways did they? And I guess I ask this because there are certain people who are individuals who are way more resilient when it comes to going through traumatic experiences and or metabolizing and processing trauma than others. And I think there's also, I would be interested to learn more about if there's cultures that also are like that and what that entails, you know? Is there an awareness that there were sort of these ways we carried harm in our bodies? And if so, how did they talk about it and express it, you know? Yeah. So all that, I was thinking about that as David was talking.
Yeah, man, that opens up so many wonderings for me as well. Like even his description of, you know, the demonic and even what we might think of as, you know, demonic possession. I'm putting that in scare quotes, listener. Because there's not a hard line in the, you know, in the Greek and the New Testament between like oppression and possession. But there are clearly people... You know, what is the relationship between people in the Gospels who are said to have demons, you know, or need deliverance from demonic oppression? Is that related to trauma in some way? You know, is there some sort of experience, you know, that people had of trauma that caused what they thought of as, you know, demonic oppression? It's a fascinating question. In a lot of ways. And I, you know, because part of what we're learning about trauma or the way that we describe it now that seems to bear out in people's experience is that it isn't what happened to you, right? It's how you metabolize and interpret or not what happened to you.
It's how your body stores and codes your experiences.
Right. What does this mean?
And so you could yell at me like you do. no, I'm just kidding. You could yell at me and yell at another person. And I don't store it as trauma, and they do.
Right.
Same. Yeah. You could be yelling the same things.
Yes.
About how your food is cold or whatever.
Right. And somebody might look at it and go, "Oh, that guy's having a bad day. Doesn't have anything to do with me." But somebody else is like, "Oh, this means I'm a bad person." You know. And that has to do. I mean, it has to do with the mind-body connection, right? Because trauma is stored in our bodies, but it has to do with how we interpret the things that have happened to us. And so that gets back to, you know, what he talked about, you know, the God, maybe the God that weird people, to bring back to that book that you're talking about, the weirdest people in the world, maybe the God that we have been conditioned to believe in, like that, having that God in our minds makes us maybe perhaps more vulnerable to trauma because we have this idea that God's going to bless me if I do the right things, You know, we read the Beatitudes and we think, oh, yeah, I can be poor in spirit. I can be merciful. I can be all these things. And that means I'm going to be blessed. And then something terrible happens to us and we think, oh, well, God didn't hold up God's end of the bargain here.
Yeah.
But there's like that, that's, you know, part of the lens that we have that, you know, as he was saying, that that God dies. That was an interesting way of phrasing it.
Yes.
And that that is a harrowing journey, but probably a necessary journey and ultimately a blessed journey. Because that God's not worth following or worshiping.
Yep.
I don't think.
Yeah. Woo! Well, right. There's so much more to say here. I appreciate David's a fellow Episcopal priest.
Yeah.
It's clear that he loves the scriptures and Jesus. Let the listener understand. All right. I think that's it, Ben.
All right.
Let's get out of here. I don't feel comfortable telling a joke right
okay.
now.
Okay.
Mostly because half of the enjoyment I get is...
Oh,
no, what? No, 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 no. Half the enjoyment I get like is kind of sucker punching Christy with a joke.
Yeah, she's not here. I've sort of I've insulated myself from the effects of your jokes successfully, so you no longer get joy. I see them coming from a mile away, and I roll my eyes and just leave the room.
All right,
or yell at you about my food. Anyway, I don't know.
It's cold.
Yeah, my food's cold.
All right, listener.
Yeah, we'll see you next time.
Catch you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.